Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me is a man who is neither the son of Zebedee nor the son of Alpheus. It's James Hull.
Way over my head.
Last time you mentioned that James, so James is from the Bible,
right? Oh, yeah.
And we're like, oh yeah, like there were two apostles named James, right? One is the son of Zebedee and the son of Alpheus. So I looked that up, and
okay.
The son of Zebedee was the one who wrote the book of James, I think, but I could be wrong. Okay, anyways,
now we have continuity between two episodes. All right, so disclaimer.
All right.
Nothing in this podcast is investment advice. This podcast is for, entertainment, but also some information, and the information should not be relied upon for investment decisions. So this is mostly entertainment, or what we try to do is entertainment. Yeah, so while we try not to, we and our guests may get their numbers wrong. So, you know, do your own research. Also, this podcast is recorded in the past, and our views that are expressed here may no longer be relevant, or we might change our minds. So yeah, do your own research.
Yeah. Also, make sure you go to technode.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. Today we have Brian Ma. Brian is a VP of Devices Research at IDC, and he's going to talk about we're going to give a little bit of an update on how Xiaomi's doing and talk about, you know, the hardware business, particularly in Asia right now. But we had recorded an interesting conversation, and we enjoyed it quite a bit. And I think there's some good nuggets there.
Oh, lots of good stuff. Lots of good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So just a rundown of just some of the news. A lot of it is continuation of kind of these broader trends, right? Of decoupling and U.S. China tech stuff, and then but one of them is we're seeing just about every single company that is a major Chinese company that is listed in the U.S. do a dual listing in Hong Kong now. One of the more recent ones now is that Bilibili apparently seems to be looking into or preparing to do it and raise about $1.5 billion. Another story that's been in the news is that it seems as though the U.S. is exploring kind of curbs on Ant Group, which as we spoke with about last episode, is preparing for an IPO, or maybe the biggest IPO in history, and Tencent's payment systems. Do we have any idea about what exactly the consequences will be if they end up, you know, putting these sanctions in place on Ant Group and Tencent payments?
Well, I mean, it depends on what the sanctions are, but if it's just kind of restricting them from being allowed to be used in the U.S., I don't think it'll impact them that much, because I don't think U.S.-based transactions are significant to them.
Mm.
So I don't, but if it's something bigger about kind of dollar access, something that would be like a really big deal. I kind of doubt they would do that. That's kind of like pulling a red card, you know, that would be a big deal. Yeah. I don't think there'll be that big of an impact, but just, you know, it does signify, you know, just kind of a less favorable environment for Chinese companies in the U.S., I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another story in the news. So iQIYI finished kind of an internal review.
Yeah.
After earlier this year, there was that, or was it last year? I think earlier this year, there was that short report, and then also SEC investigations. So this is one step, and they say that their internal investigation did not find any wrongdoing, but that's kind of like, at the same time, that's kind of like me saying, you know, mom and dad, let me go play outside today. I cleaned my room. I promise that I did not just throw everything in my closet and underneath the bed. Here, my best friend, who I'm going to go play with outside, they can vouch for me, right? That is that's not exactly you know, I mean, it is one step of the way, but it is not exactly you know, the most convincing or the most credible report.
Yeah, the good thing in that little news piece is that they're going to continue to cooperate with the SEC. So, you know, maybe that means there is some actual cooperation going on, which would be positive. You know, I think I've said it before. I wrote a piece in TechNote about a little bit about it, but it would be great to see kind of cooperation in that area between the U.S. and China. I think it's probably the easiest, the lowest hanging fruit, if you will, in the relationship right now. So
yeah.
The other things we got, Alibaba is doing a strategic JV with DuFry. Maybe I'm saying that wrong. In China, Alibaba is gonna invest.
It's the duty free.
Yeah. DuFry is the duty-free company. I think they're Swiss. Yeah, they're Swiss, and they're basically almost everywhere, but they're just about everywhere in the world. And duty-free is a pretty good business, and there's definitely kind of a little bit of a monopoly, duopoly, oligopoly thing going on there. But in China, they weren't really in China, and the big thing that's happening is Hainan is becoming basically like a duty-free island in China.
Mm.
And that's going to be kind of a big deal, probably going to lead to a lot of tourism down there and to go buy stuff. And Alibaba is probably trying to get in a little bit early, set up this JV with a big duty-free company that has access to all of that supply of, you know, products and relationships, brands and everything to get the stuff there. Alibaba is investing 9.99% into DuFry. They'll have that much ownership. And then the JV that they're setting up will be 51% Alibaba, 49% DuFry. So
this is my thought here is that this is mainly towards like Chinese consumers. And I mean anyone who's familiar with the Chinese consumer market knows that you know, duty free is something that is. Or have you ever been to an international airport in the last 10 years? You'll know that duty free is something that I think is a, you know, if you look at a lot of these Chinese tourists kind of checklists, you know, duty free is something that that tends to be quite popular with the Chinese demographic. And if they're not traveling as much internationally because of COVID, it does seem like if you have a duty free kind of hub in Hainan, you know, that seems to be seems like it's a great opportunity to get some of those domestic kind of tourist shopping dollars or travel shopping dollars that has been so big and so important to so many of these retailers for the past decade or two.
Yeah, I think one of the special things when you're traveling outside of China and you live there and you're flying back after a big vacation, you know, like Chinese New Year or the holiday that's going on, I guess just finished, is that when you get on the plane, if you need to use the overhead, you better get in there quickly.
Right.
Because there's going to be a lot of bags and stuff from duty-free shops that, fills up there. But yeah, I've been down to Hainan. They actually have a duty-free, one of the bays down there, I've been to a duty-free shop, and it's like, you know, many floors, huge, pretty crowded, you know, in a place that's, there's not a whole lot around. It's like kind of, I went off season and there was still quite a lot of people. So yeah. So that's, yeah.
You know, obviously like these Chinese, you know, we're hitting this, you know, we're hitting kind of the mid autumn right now. And, this is the time when, you know, a lot of these folks in China would be, you know, planning their visits down to, to Thailand or to Bali or wherever, and they're not going to be doing that this year. And that's a great opportunity there in Hainan. But I used to do, you know, for those who have been expats in China and have had times where they are, not on an employment visa or a resident visa and need to do a visa run, which I think we've all been in that situation one time or another. You know, the easiest one to do would always be to go to Korea, right? To fly into Seoul and then come back. And it's something just to fly somewhere, stay at the airport and come back is something that generally would you think would not be very common. But there is a whole business around this at the Seoul airport with people flying from Beijing to Seoul, not leaving the airport and coming back. And some of it, obviously, for me, it was a visa run. But for a lot of folks, you know, it was to shop.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So they would set up these duty free stores would basically set up on the airplane where you could just put your order in on the airplane. You get off the plane, they have it all ready for you. And then you get right back on another flight and come back.
Yep.
You know, it's pretty incredible, you know, the business models that are set up around this. And obviously, to make it worth it, you know, you buy a $100 plane ticket at least, you know, you end up buying quite a bit. And then that's where the overhead compartment issues come in. But anyways, that's an interesting move from Alibaba here. And it's just another case of them, you know, continuing to grow that empire and just, you know, they are never standing still. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Anything else before we go to our...
So just quickly looking at the numbers here, it's their EBITDA margins are about, last year they were 25%, but usually they're around 10 to 13%. So it's not like a hugely high margin thing, but it is very stable and just has like very nice, you know, revenue growth. They did an acquisition a while ago, which caused a big jump. But yeah, anyway, I think we should move on.
All right. Let's go on to our interview with Brian Ma. Joining us today is Brian Ma, VP of Devices Research at IDC. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
On the surface, you know, I thought, I had predicted when we did kind of our end of 2019 predictions for 2020, I was feeling pretty good about Xiaomi. I had predicted, I thought that they were kind of underpriced at the end of last year. And I had predicted that they'd have a better year for their stock than Facebook. And then the pandemic hit, you know, they were going to open up this brand new headquarters in Wuhan right as the pandemic hit. And, you know, we had supply chain issues. Their biggest international market in India has kind of been booting out these Chinese tech firms. And yet, despite all these headwinds, they're still doing pretty well. I mean, their stock has doubled since the start of the year. What has allowed Xiaomi to succeed in the face of such headwinds?
Sure. There's like you said, despite all the challenges that we see on paper, there's been a lot of things going for it in its favor. And I think, you know, what's reflected in the stock price is investors are very encouraged by a couple of things, right? One is you look at just in the most recent quarter, you look at how the profits turned out. It's a reflection of both the increase in the average selling price in the phones. And we can talk a little bit more about that in a second. They've been, you know, basically moving out of that low-end rut, if you will, and being able to move upwards on that, but also the advertising revenue, which is, again, comes back to their original IPO pitch about them being an internet services, quote unquote, internet services play. And that's helped things. But also, I think the other thing that's helping to fuel a lot of the optimism for them is, interestingly enough, some of the challenges that Huawei is going through, right? Basically, with Huawei basically having all of their suppliers getting cut off one by one, they're retreating more and more from the smartphone market, which opens up the door to other vendors, whether that's Samsung, whether that's Xiaomi, whether it's Oppo and Vivo, whoever it is. And particularly in Western Europe, we have seen Xiaomi become quite aggressive in, you know, their efforts there, you know, cranking up a lot of the advertising, where Huawei used to be, for instance. It's pretty clear they're salivating at that wake that's been created in Huawei's absence, right? And we're seeing that reflected in their shipments as well, too. In the most recent quarter, they've been the number one smartphone vendor in markets like Spain. They're making progress in markets like France, Germany, and even beyond Western Europe. You look at markets like Russia, where they've been quite strong. You know, I guess that what I'm getting at is that investor optimism is probably also encouraged by them seeing Xiaomi making progress outside of China and the potential opportunity that can be for them. So quite a few things going for them. Yeah, despite the challenges you mentioned,
it's almost like they've kind of had this kind of trade off with Huawei, where they've lost market share domestically because in China, I think that Huawei's had this sort of like patriotism boost, but outside of China, Huawei, because of their issues with their app store and, you know, these sanctions, they've struggled, and Xiaomi's kind of taken up you know, where Huawei has left off there. James, you can ask the next question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so are some of those phones that they're selling and gaining market share in Western Europe, are those higher ASP phones that they're selling there?
No, they tend to be low and mid-range type phones, right? That actually tends to play well to a market like Spain, which has a relatively lower average selling price than the rest of the region there. But nonetheless, it is you compare it to a market like India, for instance, where the average selling price of a phone is, say, $130 US, right? You know, that's relative to that, Western Europe is still at a higher average selling price, which is probably your point here, right? So that's also helping that a bit. But I think the other thing, you know, to this point on the average selling prices, don't forget as well, too, that part of what's driving that ASP increase is also how Xiaomi has been more successful at marketing its flagship phones, right? Particularly the Mi 10. We saw a good amount of volumes for that, including markets like China. And they've been doing quite well. And they've been, you know, for the past couple of years, they've been trying to get out of that. They've been stuck in that, that low-end price perception hole where they've always been perceived as that lower-end brand, right? And especially with the success of the Redmi brand. You know, they're a victim of their own success, right? They did so well with the Redmi brand. They kind of got that perception of being a low-end player. And yet they've been able to, I guess, wriggle themselves a bit free of that perception with flagship products like the Mi 10 and how well the camera performs, as well as, you know, a lot of the glitzy stuff that they've been showing off, like the wraparound Mi Mix Alpha, the one with the wraparound screen. You know, they've been showing off some potential foldables, which they haven't officially announced, but they've kind of hinted at. So they've been really trying to drive that message that, look, we are an innovator. You know, we've got stuff that others don't have. And that has also helped to push some of that volume upwards as well, too, in terms of ASP.
Well, you mentioned India there. I want to talk a little bit more about that. I mean, Xiaomi's success there, I don't know if our listeners will be aware, but there was when they started having this real big success in India, you know, they had a big event there, and their CEO, Lei Jun, said, you know, to this whole English-speaking audience, he was trying to say, how are you doing? But he said, are you okay? And it kind of has been this kind of self-deprecating kind of catchphrase that has followed Xiaomi around ever since. But what's interesting, kind of the context behind that, is that Xiaomi really took off in India at probably midpoint of last decade and got a lot of kind of genuine kind of grassroots momentum there. Now, the other side of that is that we know that essentially, a lot of these Chinese tech companies have been completely booted out of India's kind of internet stack, right? That you know, WeChat's banned, TikTok's banned, and so on and so forth. But Xiaomi still seems to be doing okay. How have they been able to maintain this presence? Are they? Do you think that they're in trouble, or what are they doing to stay alive there?
Yeah, they're doing quite well in India. And as much as there might be political pressure that might be bearing down, I think they're still going to be all right. They have a commanding lead in India. They've been the number one vendor there for the past almost 3 years now. And while certainly, you know, the tensions between India and China are creating some windfall, if you will, for competitors like Samsung, who is one of the few non-Chinese vendors there. The reality is, if you look at the India smartphone market, 3 out of 4, 4 out of 5 smartphones there are basically coming from Chinese vendors. So from an India consumer perspective, there really isn't much else of a choice. When you're in the market for a smartphone there, I mean, yeah, you could go for a Samsung. You might be able to go for a local vendor like Micromax, which is seeing a little bit of a resurgence now thanks to some of this. But the reality is the bulk of smartphones available there, when you walk into a retail store, most of those are from Chinese brands, whether it's Xiaomi or Oppo or Vivo or whomever it might be. Realme, for instance, that Oppo spinoff has been doing quite well there too. And so in that sense, Xiaomi is a bit protected from that. And more importantly, don't forget, Xiaomi has had so much momentum going in India for so many years now, and they've been really positioning themselves as a local vendor in the midst of this crisis. You look at a lot of the badging that they've been doing for many of their retail outlets. They basically say made in India, right? You know, they're really emphasizing their, I guess, roots, if you will, in India, their manufacturing base in India. And, you know, even the launch events that they host online, you know, a lot of that being done in local language as well too, right? So they're really catering to that. And so I don't think they're going to be as affected by this, even though, yes, you can't completely dismiss the pressure. It's certainly there. But the other thing to also keep in mind, too, is a lot of this, the tension, the India-China tension, you could argue is also we need to be careful about not overblowing it either, right? I mean, yes, the tension is there. It is present in the large cities, and we certainly do see it on social media, but social media might be amplifying it a bit more than it really is. There is a big part of the demographic that, you know, this sort of issue hasn't been as much of a problem. And so, like I said, I mean, I'm not trying to dismiss the fact that there are tensions between China and India. As you pointed out, certainly from an app perspective, we're seeing a lot of these apps being blacklisted or getting booted out or whatever it is. But from a phone perspective, that's not as much of an issue. And Xiaomi in particular, I think, has done, you know, they've taken those steps to mitigate that, and to the point where it's not really going to be that much of an issue.
Just on India, another question. I mean, I saw some news that Reliance Jio and Google are potentially working together on Android flavor for India. You think that would be, I mean, would that be on a device that could be competing with Xiaomi? And do you think, you know, going forward, they'd still have, you know, kind of a stronger foothold there?
In theory, yes. In practice, we have a lot of concerns about Jio's claims. You know, of course, Jio at their AGM didn't really say a whole lot. Or when the Google investment was made, they didn't say a whole lot. They just said, we're partnering with Google. I think Bloomberg did a piece that cited a source that said, oh, you know, they're going to do a $54 price point, and they are looking at, what is it, something like 200 million units over the course of 2 years. For reference, to put that in the context, total number of smartphones that ship in India each year is about 130, approaching 150 million a year, right? So if we were to, at a highly oversimplified level, if we take that 200 million, annualize 200 million over 2 years, annualize it to 100 million per year, compare that to the existing base today, if we take that at face value, it could be very, very big, right? But we have a lot of concerns about whether or not they can really hit that kind of a price point. It's not clear where subsidies come in. It's not clear how manufacturing comes into play here, how taxes come into play. So far, we're very, very, I guess, I don't want to say skeptical. We're conservative in our outlook, or we remain a bit refrained in terms of whether we think Jio is really going to hit the volumes that at least the Bloomberg piece claimed. And so it might not make that much of a difference. And don't forget as well, too, that $54 price point for these Jio phones is still two or three times the price of a feature phone there, which is actually the target user that Jio is trying to migrate up. So Jio may or may not be that successful with that product. In the meantime, coming back to Xiaomi, right, you look at where Xiaomi is really successful in India, that's at a price point of like $130. So you could argue it's a slightly different demographic here, or it is a different demographic, I should say. Might not quite be that target user that Jio is going after.
Okay, but if they don't get to 54 and they get to $100, maybe then they end up kind of around the same. You know, anyway, that's super interesting.
Yeah, fair point. I mean, I think it'll also be interesting to see what that final product ultimately looks like. What is that user experience? Yeah. And that's kind of where, you know, Xiaomi comes in and says, hey, you know what? Look, at $130, we can get you this awesome camera and this great gaming experience and this and that. Whereas maybe, oh, that Jio phone, yeah, you're just going to be able to do Instagram and YouTube and your WhatsApp. And
that's need games these days.
Yeah, exactly. And in India, PUBG Mobile is huge, or at least was huge until this app ban hit. But yeah.
So, Brian, you and I are both based in Southeast Asia, yourself in Singapore and me in Bangkok. One thing that I've noticed just with an eye out for these things is how much Xiaomi, the popularity of their IoT devices has really grown in Southeast Asia. You know, the other day I was at the park and, you know, talking to a neighbor of mine, you know, we're both walking our dogs. And he had a camera that he has to watch his dog whenever he is not in the house, right? something that adults with no children and only dogs do, right? But I was like, oh yeah, who makes it? Oh, it's Xiaomi, right? And then he went on to tell me about all these other, you know, kind of low cost but kind of nifty, fun IoT devices that he has that are Xiaomi. And it's really been interesting to me to see how you know, how wide and broad their IoT suite is, and how much they're trying to get really hit price points that are affordable in some of these developing markets. So can you tell us a little bit more about what they've been doing in IoT and where you anticipate kind of them expanding to in the future with that?
Sure. You know, obviously, as we all know, in their IPO roadshow, one of their big pitches was that, you know, they're not going to be completely reliant on smartphones. It's about them and their broader ecosystem, including IoT devices, you know, all these smart home devices, but also, of course, internet services and that sort of thing. Now, to the point on these IoT devices, you know, they've obviously, in their home market of China, you know, it's a full-fledged, you know, you walk into these Xiaomi stores, you can buy toothbrushes and towels and dishes and that sort of
everything.
Thing. What I've been watching for, yeah, exactly, everything, right? What I've been watching for is how they progress in deploying similar products in overseas markets, just as with their internet services, right? So far, we haven't seen a whole lot of those services in overseas markets just yet. India and Indonesia, maybe some exceptions there. But yeah, one of the things I'm watching for is how they progress in deploying things like TVs, like routers, like whatever sort of products it might be, light bulbs and that sort of thing, smart light bulbs. Which they have been doing in India over the past year, quite aggressively, in fact, right? They've been doing very, very well in smart TVs there. And, you know, just the various sorts of things, everything from whether it's a scooter or, you know, toys and all that kind of stuff, they've been progressively deploying more and more of that. Now, again, I think what's critical to keep in mind in all this is a lot of this is very country dependent, country by country dependent, right? India is probably where they've been the most aggressive thus far with a lot of this stuff. You know, I think Elliot, as you pointed out, yeah, they've got some stuff in Thailand, here in Singapore. There's a bit, there's a few stores here and there that do sell it, but I wouldn't go so far as to say it's common where many people will say, oh yeah, I'm going to go to the Xiaomi store to buy that light, because they're still usually thinking of IKEA or, you know, the regular furniture stores or whatever it might be. But they are here. They are physically here. I'm one of the few exceptions where, just because I'm in the industry and I'm naturally curious, I did go and buy things like a Xiaomi TV and this Xiaomi lamp that I have over here by my bedside. But I'm probably one of the few exceptions. So it will depend on the country. They don't necessarily have the full suite of products available in all the countries here in Southeast Asia. And I guess for me, it is that bellwether. It's that indicator that I'm looking for to see how complete their vision is, how well they're executing towards that vision that they were pitching at their roadshow. Because if you look at most of their overseas efforts, yeah, they've been going in smartphones first, right? Smartphones lead, and then where do the other things follow after that? Is it a lot of these IoT products? Is it some of these services beyond just advertising and the app store and games and that kind of thing? What about stuff like money, lending, right? They do personal lending as a service.
In China, yeah.
These very, yeah, correct. Or things like, you know, music downloads and all that kind of stuff. Music streaming services, I should say.
Cloud storage.
Outside of markets like India, where they have been doing that. Yeah, correct. Exactly. Services like that. We really haven't seen a whole lot of that in markets outside of China, aside from, again, maybe markets like India and a little bit in Indonesia. So, you know, these are the kind of those leading indicators that I'm looking for in terms of the progress they're making in overseas markets.
If they have that's kind of these IoT devices really take off, like they seem to be in some places, it just seems like the potential there is so great because there's so many ways to monetize it. You know, if you know when someone's brushing their teeth, if you know when they're turning off their lamp at night, I mean, it's obviously there's the wearable segment. If you have their little Roomba vacuum robot, right? If you're videotaping their pets all day, you know, the amount of kind of granular data that they can have on people's home lives is just something that you're not going to see other companies
be
able to have.
That's kind of scary.
Oh, it's horrifying. but it is.
I think one of the things whenever I hear about IoT that just pops up in my head is the security issues. If you talk to anybody who's in cybersecurity about IoT, they tend to go, "Oh God, oh God," and they, you know, it's terrifying to them because they know how bad it is, and it's bad. It's, I mean, security wise, IoT's got a long way to go. There's probably a long way to go too for, you know, edge compute and edge storage and all that stuff. So there's, but that's different types of IoT probably.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I'm curious, and maybe both of you guys can chime in on this, but like, you know, Brian, you know, you're looking at all these different types of electronic devices, mobile devices, you know, the pandemic's been kind of going on all year almost. Has it changed any trends, anything that you're seeing kind of compared to last year, the last few years?
Yeah, well, PCs are doing a lot better than before, right? All this work from home, all this study from home activity.
Office, yeah.
Yeah, and for that matter, entertain at home. It's really driven up, you know, the volumes of PCs to the point where the industry is in shortage right now, right? Demand totally exceeds supply. And it's been this way for a couple of quarters now.
Is that mostly laptops?
Yeah, particularly laptops. But even things like tablets, like monitors for that matter, these things have all surged. And smartphones, to some degree, have been negatively impacted by this in the sense of a consumer's wallet being diverted over to these sorts of products, then maybe they'll hold off a bit on that flagship phone upgrade for a little bit because, oh, I had to go buy a Chromebook for my kid to, you know, do remote learning or whatever it might be. Yeah. So if anything, we've been, you know, in fact, I can give you a few figures here in case it'll help. You know, if we look at, say, the PC market this year in 2020, the PC market, we're expecting 3% growth in unit terms. You contrast that with the smartphone market, which we're expecting to contract by about 10% in unit terms. So, yeah, exactly. And so this is something where we've really just seen the market move in two different directions. But, you know, smartphones are still going to be a pivotal part of our lives, right? In fact, if anything, as 5G gets deployed in the upcoming years, we're expecting that to be one of the main drivers, particularly in China. And we've seen a lot of that momentum already. But yeah, that's, you know, that's the situation.
So, it sounds like the PC sales seem to be maybe a one-time kind of boost that they're getting this year. And maybe next year, you know, you're not going to buy another Chromebook for your kid to do classes again, right?
Well, two schools of thought on that. Personally, our forecasts have been, we've tried to stay a bit conservative because we're very concerned about macroeconomic pressures bearing down on the market, right? SMBs going out of business, people losing their jobs, losing their source of income. You know, eventually that's going to negatively hit the market. But the flip side of this, the other argument here, and you know, if you listen to, let's say, Lenovo's earnings call most recently, they were making the argument that, you know, previously we might have had one PC per household. Now in this new COVID era, we are moving into an era where it's one PC per household member, right? And that's dramatically increasing the addressable market for them.
Probably good for Wi-Fi routers.
Yeah, that as well too, right? And so why, you know, to your point, when we look at our forecast, we certainly do expect 2020 to benefit quite well from a lot of this trend. The big question is, how long does it last, right? Is it just the short-term blip? Do we reach that point of saturation where people already have enough devices, or is there still a lot more to go? To my earlier point, you know, at what point does the macroeconomic pressure catch up to it? The reality, when does that reality bear down on that market? And that's the big unanswered question as we look at, you know, a lot of what's going on in the supply chain, for instance. We see a lot of orders being placed by OEMs going through, you know, the end of this calendar year. But as we look into 2021, it's a big black hole. A lot of uncertainty from the supply chain about whether it can be sustained. Some of the component suppliers are a bit optimistic. They think that it might be able to be sustained. And so one of the things we're constantly watching here is, you know, whether we need to lift up that 2021 forecast. To be honest, we're expecting declines going into 21 in the PC market. We're concerned about whether, you know, if we're going to be wrong on that forecast, then the risk is actually an upside risk rather than a downside risk, right? Basically, that market, if we're wrong, that market might actually end up beating our forecast. And that's the thing we're trying to figure out is whether or not that can be sustained beyond just the short term.
When you look at all that stuff, do you also look at replacement cycles for laptops and PCs? And like, what kind of trend, what's like the current view on replacement cycle there?
Yeah. So yes, replacement cycles obviously figure into this. And again, that'll vary by type of device. Notebooks, let's say a 2-year lifespan as opposed to desktops, which will be longer. It'll also depend by country and by segment and that sort of thing. And that all gets fed into our model. But I think the thing that, you know, to this earlier point about, let's say, Lenovo's optimism, you know, that's not so much about existing users replacing devices. It's about new users, right? The kids now having their own PCs and, you know, individuals maybe having their own personally owned devices rather than just what the company issues and that sort of thing. And that's the interesting part. And again, to my earlier point, how much does the individual household's income or confidence that they're going to get that next paycheck, you know, when does that factor into this? If that confidence gets lost, hey, then maybe I can't afford that notebook anymore and I'm not going to buy it. And that eventually starts to come about. So yeah, obviously the economic indicators are a very critical factor here to watch.
I wonder what if kids using laptops have a shorter replacement cycle just because
they beat up
of accidents and things. But anyway, yeah, we don't need to get to it.
It's like a PlayStation controller that gets thrown against the wall all the time. No, I mean, a lot of these accessories, you know, from, you know, because of working from home and everything, I have bought, I mean, the listeners can't see this, but I'm showing you guys in the video chat my new ring light that I purchased on Lazada a few weeks ago. Just because
it's a live streaming ring light, isn't it?
Well, it's something that, I mean, you could use it in, I'm not using it right now, but you could use it in calls. But also, like, for example, one thing that's changed is, so I will do like TV quite regularly, where I'll just, you know, on a news program, you know, do a segment for 5 minutes or whatever. And in the past, oftentimes there would be an expectation that I would go to a studio to record it. Now, because these norms are changing, the idea of just recording at home, you know, I'll be cooking in the kitchen and then be like, okay, you're going to be on TV in 5 minutes. So then I'll just stop cooking and go to the other room and record it. But I noticed the lighting was always an issue. So I bought a ring light, you know, a couple of years ago, I would think that only, you know, these kind of makeup tutorial girls would do it. But I guess I'm one of those now. But anyways, it is interesting. All the different things you're going to buy to kind of set up your, you know, your home office. But anyways, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. And how can our listeners, if they're interested in following you more, reading what you write, how can they get in touch with you or follow your work more?
Sure. Easiest way is on Twitter. My handle is @BrianBMA. That's Brian with a Y. So BrianBMA. And yeah. Love to have more chats. This is great.
Awesome.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you. Thanks again to Brian Ma from IDC. Brian has been with IDC for like 2 decades. He is he knows his stuff, and he's one of the true pros. But yeah, really, you know, just a fascinating space. I think, you know, the hardware space in Asia, obviously, it's kind of, you know, the Shenzhen and you know, is kind of around which everything kind of you know, orbits. But you know, it's just a fascinating space because there's so much growth here, and also, you know, it's where when we talked about these kind of like leapfrog capacities in these developing markets, but so much of it is happening around here. So so thanks again to Brian for chatting with us. Any takeaways that you have there?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear, you know, just how localized Xiaomi got. I mean, I know they have their CEO for India is Indian, and they bring him on earnings calls and stuff. So that's like, I mean, it's very cool to see they're, you know, they're really going deep there. If they and it's probably going to bring them some protection. You know, actually, at the end, I kind of wanted to ask them a question about 5G phone, you know, expectations and what was going on, because in my conversations in China, there's a lot of construction going on with 5G being rolled out and all this, but there's a big difference between like standalone 5G networks and non-standalone 5G networks, and the non-standalone ones, based on kind of my checks, channel checks and stuff, where is mostly what's being built, and that's like they're still relying on the old 4G kind of backbone. And so and just putting 5G kind of at the endpoints, the edges. And that's, you know, it's good. It'll show up as 5G, but the speeds won't be quite as good as if it was completely standalone 5G. So anyway, yeah, Brian definitely knows his stuff. I was impressed. We threw questions at him that he did not know beforehand. So
yeah. But I mean, when you've been in the business for as long as he has, I mean, he has an encyclopedic knowledge. It's really incredible.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, it's hard to know with 5G because it's one of those things where it's like it's almost like the smartphone, right? Where when the smartphone came out, we were like, okay, well, how do you actually use this? and then all of these applications get built on top of it once we fully understand, you know, what can be done with it. Same thing with like the camera phone, right? But yeah, it's hard to know exactly, you know, how much it needs to actually, that infrastructure needs to get built out, but also
how badly do you need it?
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't need it that badly, don't buy it now. Buy the Gen 2, Gen 3 models that are probably going to be, you know, the same price as the Gen 1 or maybe even a little more, but maybe there'll be cheaper options too. But I'm pretty sure Apple will keep their prices pretty high.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, we've had a similar conversation around VR for so long, right? Where there has to be some sort of application that makes it so that you want to actually get a VR headset, and we haven't had that yet, right? You know, it's the you know, I bought a Nintendo Switch because of the Zelda game, right? That there has to be something that, well, I need to get this so that I can do this activity. And we don't really know quite what that's going to be with 5G yet, but obviously, you know, there are so many possibilities there. Anyways, techno.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. You can follow us on Twitter. James is James Hull X, JamesHullX, and I'm Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTZAAGMAN. And also please make sure to give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us a positive review or wherever you get your podcasts, you know, share the podcast with your friend, share it on social media. That's all very, very helpful to us. Anything else?
Yeah, we appreciate that.
Anything else we should say?
Yeah, I mean, we also have a China Tech Invest podcast Twitter account, which is just China Tech Invest. Investor was too long, so we just did China Tech Invest. You can follow that as well. Yep, that's all.
All right. Thanks again to all of our listeners and to everybody who helps make this possible. And we'll catch you all next time on the China Tech Investor podcast. Bye-bye now.
Bye.